Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who has a vast collection of vintage DC and Marvel comic books, and ironically lives in Minnesota, where his favorite NBA team, the LA Lakers, originated, Dave Denniston.
Hello, my friends. This is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, the podcast dedicated to helping doctors like you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. Well, one of the other missions that I have in the podcast is to inspire entrepreneurship, to help 100 new physicians reach multi-millionaire status, to provide for the future and make an impact. And I am honored to have a friend here with me that is a serial entrepreneur. He has owned 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 different businesses. I don't know how many. I'm going on here. He has owned a landscaping business, sold that. He owned a printing business, which I think he sold that. He owns some storage facilities, which we're going to talk about that, and I believe he sold one of those or two of those. And now he's also getting into the land business, and that's how he and I met. And so I am just honored to have him here with me, where we're going to just chat and get to know stuff. He was sharing stuff with me before this interview even started. I was like, what? This is crazy. Please help me welcome Jeff Detmer. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks, Dave. Glad to be here.
All right, Jeff. Well, let's tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us a little thumbnail sketch. Who are you? Where are you from? What are you about?
Well, I live in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. It's actually the same suburb that I was born in. I was born probably about a block and a half from where I live right now. I've traveled a little bit further than that in my life, but as my wife would say, he hasn't traveled very far. <'Cause> I went to college right here. Our family's business was a printing company. And I grew up in that business, working there as a little kid, kind of child slave labor kind of a thing. you know, if you want to eat dinner, we got to collate this job, things like that, because the job was sitting out on the dining room table. So once the job was done, then we could sit down and have dinner. And I'm not joking. That literally happened more than
wow.
Once. But I went to college, got a degree in business marketing. And really, I've been working my whole life as a little kid at the printing company, and then, as you mentioned, the lawn service, and spent 20 years after college running the printing company. And during that time, I invested in various pieces of real estate. About a year out of college, the first house I bought was a 4-family. That I lived in. I was house hacking before I even knew the term. and I lived in it and rented out the other 3 units. And I've done various things over those 20 years. And frankly, that allowed me to, when we sold the printing company, to not have to go get a job. And since then, I have continued on expanding my real estate empire, if you want to call it that, my little empire, and that's what I'm supporting my family. Married, I've got 2 boys, 12 and 13, getting pretty close to 13 and 14, and that's
teenagers.
That's me
eating
in a snapshot.
Eating you out of house and home.
Yeah, exactly.
You need to sell some more land, Jeff. Feed that family.
Definitely.
Walk us through, you mentioned all of these different experiences, and you started out with helping your dad with the printing business, and you were telling me a story before the podcast began of how you learn your ABCs. So why don't you share that with us? I'd love for you to tell that story.
Well, I can't tell you what age this was, but it was really young, and I got to give you a little bit of context. My dad started our printing company in 1967. He borrowed $300 to buy a used printing press because he didn't have $300. And he and my grandpa, his father, they moved this printing press themselves. And they moved it into the basement of my grandparents' house. And at this time, my dad was finishing up college after spending 4 years in the Air Force. He and my mom had been newly married for about 2.5 years. And in college, or in high school, he was a photographer. He actually did weddings while he was in high school. So there's something in the genes here about entrepreneurship at a very young age. But at the very beginning of the printing company, in the first number of years, it was my dad and my mom, and that was it. There were no employees. In fact, I don't think they hired the first full-time employee until I was about 7 years old, maybe 8 years old. So it was really a mom-and-pop shop, and they did pretty much everything. And one of the things that happened was that work was brought home, whether it was collating work or things that needed to be stapled or sorted or organized. And as kids, my sister and I would be very involved in that. And one of the things was my dad would, this is before computers really, my dad would have the invoices that were customers paid, and he had a file that he kept the paid invoices in, and the invoices were always alphabetized. That way he could reference them throughout the year. New year, he'd start a new box. And my sister and I started taking on that job of alphabetizing paid invoices. And that's really how I learned my ABCs.
That's awesome. What a great way to involve kids in the job. And it was a family business, not just your dad doing his thing. So you move on a little bit and grow up some. You were still in high school, I think, when you had launched your first business. Is that right?
Yeah, actually in junior high. I was 15, and I knew of someone else a couple years older than me, a friend, a family friend, who ended up marrying my sister years later. But he was cutting grass in the neighborhood or in our town, and he'd go around and he would cut people's lawns and make money. And I thought, well, that seems like a pretty easy way to earn some money. And so I started and cut the lady's lawn up the street. And then someone else heard that I was cutting grass, and then they wanted to hire me. And then someone else did. I'm like, I haven't even done anything, and these customers are just coming to me. And so I went out and I invested in a Honda lawnmower. And at 15, I spent $585.75 of my own money and bought this Honda lawnmower, and I started cutting grass. And some of my customers were in my neighborhood, and others weren't. And the ones that weren't, I had to pay my sister, who was older than me, to drive me and drop me off and then come back and pick me up to cut those lawns. Until I got my license a year later.
Wow.
But I built that business up mostly through word of mouth so quickly, and I ended up with a 52-inch Skag, one of these huge commercial lawnmowers, and some other Honda mowers and other equipment. I had a trailer that I hauled around all this stuff, and I had five guys working for me in high school.
Hold on. You had five guys working for you in high school. How did that work? Like, are you picking them up? Or are they coming to the site? Because I'm guessing your sister didn't want to haul around six guys in her car.
No. I had at that point, I had my driver's license, and I had a station wagon that I was pulling my trailer and all my equipment on the trailer, and I'd hitch it up. And one of the guys working for me lived next door, so that was easy. But I'd pick up these guys, and they weren't always working at the same time. Probably four was the most that we had working at any one time, because one kid was in this extracurricular activity, so he could only work on Tuesdays and Thursdays after school, and so everyone had different schedules, and so it's just it's just logistics coordinating all of this, and of course taking into account the weather. I don't know, I just figured it out as I went along. And I had so much business that I really couldn't keep up with it. But basically, I reinvested some of it in equipment, but I socked that money away for college. And I, in large part, paid for college cutting grass. And then my first year of college, it was really difficult because the business had grown to the point where I really needed to make a decision. Am I going to do the lawn business full-time and go to school part-time, or am I going to, like, scale back the lawn business to part-time so I can go to school full-time? Because something had to give, because I was really struggling time-wise. And so I hatched the amazing plan of the century, and that was, I'm going to raise my prices. Classic supply and demand. There's a lot of demand for me. I raise my prices. I'll lose some of my customers. So I'll have less time that I'll be required to work, and I'll make probably a similar amount of money. Yeah, I only lost one customer.
Wow.
So that plan didn't work really well, but I made a bunch more money than the next year.
Wow. And so during this whole time, you're in high school initially, or junior high, were you filing tax returns? Like, because I just see, like, a 15-year-old kid, and there's no way you're filing a tax return, right? I mean, I just can't imagine it. Was just like an all cash business, you know? Walk me through that part of the administration of the business and how you as a young person handled that.
Some things I handled better than others. A fair amount of it was a cash business. I do remember distinctly the first time that I had a customer give me a check, and then that check bounced. And so I learned about that probably about age 16 was when that happened. And that's when I learned about NSF fees. I had to go back to that customer who was, you know, old enough to be my father, which was not an easy situation. But, I went to my dad a lot about this happened. What do I do with this? Because of his entrepreneurship, his whole life, he taught me a lot, and I had been taught so much about business before I ever cut my first blade of grass for someone else. But, I mean, my dad, when he was in the third grade, he bought this watch from a jeweler that he wanted, and he negotiated with this jeweler so that he could make payments over the course of I don't know how many weeks. And every week he rode his bike like a mile to this jewelry store to make payments on this watch that he bought. In the third grade, he did this. So,
wow.
I mean, this is what I'm growing up with. This is what I'm learning from. And it was just an incredible experience. But I have to say, I think I'm 45 now, give or take. That first lawnmower, I actually still have that lawnmower, and that lawnmower still starts on the first or maybe second pull 30 years later, which is a testament to that. The way that machine was built, but also, you know, how I maintained it, because I put a lot of use on that machine, a lot more than was intended for that machine. But there was a big lesson there that I learned about buying quality things. But this lawn business, it really kind of took off, and I learned so much about business, about managing people and all of that. And then after that year in college, when I raised the prices and basically, you know, lost one customer, at that point I said, all right, I'm done. And I met this guy, and I don't remember how this happened, but I met a guy who was almost old enough to be my father, who had his own lawn business. He was looking to expand his operation, and he bought my business from me. I kept a couple pieces of equipment, like that first lawnmower, for sentimental reasons more than anything, because I certainly didn't need a lawnmower at 21. Or whatever, however old I was, and that's how I got out of the business. But I largely put myself through college from the lawn cutting. It was pretty amazing. When I think back to what I did.
Tell me about that moment, Jeff, when he bought the business. Did he just stroke you a check? Was it something he paid you over time? You know, what happened with that transaction?
You know, Dave, I don't really remember the details of that. I think that there was a couple of payments, but it wasn't over a long period of time. So it may have been one check, it may have been a couple of checks over 6 months. I don't think it was even a year of payments, but I really don't remember.
Was there a light bulb moment for you, or like, man, selling this business is a good thing? Or was it regret or kind of a mix of...
It was definitely a mix. It was bittersweet. I mean, I built this thing up from nothing. But I knew I needed to do something because it was just, it had grown too big too fast. And I wasn't the manager. You know, I was out there cutting grass with the guys. Mm. And there were times when they were cutting grass and I was talking to a customer that we were cutting their lawn. You know, I did that customer service work at the time when necessary. But predominantly, you know, I was out there sweating with the rest of them. And you know, I there were lots of problems that came up that needed to be solved, whether they were with some of the equipment or weather-related things and scheduling things. I can remember a few times, especially this time of year in the fall, when it starts to get dark really early, and, you know, we got out of school and we started cutting grass, and then it got dark really quick. And I can remember, like, having to plan so that we would start in the backyard of the last couple lawns we were doing and work towards the front because there were streetlights out front. Mm. And that helped to illuminate the front lawn. Or even turning on the headlights of my station wagon to kind of illuminate the front yard a little bit.
Wow. That's great.
So, yeah, that was a long time ago, but it was pretty impactful in my life, I believe.
Well, you're the kind of guy that you're a regular dude. I don't see you being like a flashy, even at that age. I can't imagine you get some money and then you go out and you buy a Corvette or a Mustang or something like that. What did you do with this money from this business?
Saved it.
Saved it.
For college.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't. Yeah, you're right. I'm not a flashy guy. Wasn't then. Still am not. I have shoes that I wear regularly that are more than 10 years old. Still. I hang on to things. I mean, I have that lawnmower that's over 30 years old.
have you ever read The Millionaire Mind or The Millionaire Next Door, any of those books?
Yeah, I read The Millionaire Next Door right around the time when it came out, which I think was 92, 93, 4, 5, right in there, which was right when I was in college or finishing college.
And that's you. Yeah. That's you is. In like a heartbeat.
And it's my dad too. I mean, this is where I got it from. Sometimes my mom will talk, and my dad's name is Jim, and sometimes she'll be talking to someone and she'll say, well, Jeff is more like Jim than Jim is, which is really kind of a oxymoron to even, if you really think about that, but I am very much like my dad, but in many characteristics to a greater degree than he is. And to this day, we still do a lot of projects and things together, and we're cut from the same cloth. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, beautiful. Well, I want to fast forward a little bit in your life, because we have a limited time with the podcast, and there's so much that I want to cover. You took over, I guess, at some point your dad's printing business. Or did you start your own?
No. I was actually asked to join the printing company by our longtime employee that had been there for about 20 years. He went to my dad and said, I think we need to hire Jeff to do sales. And so I was asked to join the company after college, maybe a year and a half or so, in a sales capacity. And I did that. And I... in a relatively short period of time, we basically, and it wasn't just me, but we pretty close to doubled the sales of the company within a couple years by bringing on a couple of large key clients. We did some significant modernization, computerization of some functions. My parents realized that, oh, Jeff's here now. We can go take a vacation, because they never took any time off. And so they went and took a couple-week trip out west, and while they were gone, I was tasked with doing a few additional things that were normally not my responsibilities. And that began the process of me slowly but surely taking over the operations of the company.
I apologize, I'm going to hop in here. I think through the last 30 years of what it could be like to be a printer, and I have to imagine with the digital revolution and computers and storage, you know, probably from, let's say, 1980 to the mid-90s were probably great years to be in printing. Did it slow down after that? That's kind of what I have pictured in my mind. You know, all these small printers kind of going out of business as we store more documents online. Certainly there's still printing that goes on, no doubt about it, but not the same volume.
Yeah, it didn't slow down. It just changed. And so we had to change how we did certain things because of some of the technologies. Some of the projects that we had done in the 80s, early 90s, on a very regular basis, those projects didn't need to be done anymore, largely because of changes in technology. And so at the same time, new projects or new tasks came out, and so we took on new challenges and expanded our capabilities in other ways. And it's you know, producing these things where we used to produce those things. And sometimes that required some additional training or equipment changes and updates, but it didn't slow down because we grew through that time frame and beyond, but it definitely changed. And as with most everything in this time frame, most businesses, the speed of the changes kept accelerating.
Hmm. And that lead you to sell that business then as well, with your dad at some point then, it sounds like?
Yeah, I mean, so basically, during that whole time that I was working for the printing company, I was socking money away and buying real estate and generating a good, relatively passive income from real estate. And I started out with multifamily, I did single family, and then I moved into commercial and primarily self-storage. And shortly after I got my second self-storage property, I realized I was making the same amount of money on my two self-storage properties, working maybe 10 hours a week, as I was working 60, 70 hours a week running the printing company with a lot of stress. And that's when I realized that it was time to sell the printing company because I was stressed out. And my wife and I talked about it, and then my parents go to Florida for the winter. So I called my dad because this was in the winter, and I said, I think it's time to sell. And I remember exactly what he said till the day I die. I could see him kind of nodding his head for a moment or two, and then he said, okay, make it happen.
Wow.
And that was the entire conversation. So then, added to my plate was figure out how to sell the company without customers knowing, without employees knowing, and I was able to do that, and we found a buyer really within a few months, another printing company, and going to consolidate operations into our facility. We had newer equipment, a bigger facility, and so that's what he was doing, and we closed on that. I stayed on for about 6 months transition, and then I was done, and that was in January. That'll be 3 years ago that I stopped working there. So Pretty crazy.
And now let's take a moment for a quick commercial break. Well, my friends, 4 years into this podcasting journey, I have accumulated tons and tons and tons of material from my guests, from books I've written, and everything else. And so I have created a whole system for you that I call the Freedom Formula for Physicians Prosperity Kit. This kit is every single thing that I've ever created. So if you are wanting to get an edge on your finances, if you are wanting to get that financial education all in one place, all in one box, I'm throwing the whole kitchen sink at you. My latest book, The Young Physician's Guide to Money and Life. My first book, The Freedom Guide, The Freedom Formula for Physicians. I'm going to throw in the audio CDs. I'm going to throw in copies of podcasts. I'm going to throw in a USB drive with tons and tons of material on it. I'm going to throw in workbooks that have other published works that I have had. Anything and everything that I have done is in this system, and it is less than $100. $99.87 will get you 4 years worth of my blood, sweat, and tears to help you move yourself forward. And as a special bonus, I'm going to include more about my land investing journey, what's been going on there, give you an inside scoop as to the latest and greatest and things that you might want to learn as you go along. So with that, my friends, if you are interested in moving forward, go to drfreedompodcast.com/system. Again, drfreedompodcast.com/system. drfreedompodcast.com/system. And now, back to the show.
It's been a few years and you've been socking money away in real estate. You mentioned single-family homes, multifamily, and storage facilities, which I know you still have a storage facility. Walk me through kind of what you see, and having all of these different experiences with real estate, which of those do you like the best, and which do you hate the worst, and why?
Single-family, I guess, would be the one that I like the least. I don't care how nice a neighborhood you're in, and mine are in the same town primarily that I live in, which is a nice suburban area, and they're a pain because whenever a tenant moves out, it costs a whole lot of money because of the vacancy, but also because of putting in new carpet or painting or whatever. It's a real pain, and all of your income for that property is tied up in one person. They lose their job, they turn into a little bit of crazy, whatever. It's one person.
A little bit of both.
Right. And so I don't like single family. I still have some. And as time goes on and as the opportunities present themselves, I am selling them. But I'm not running away from them. But self-storage, I learned about it from a several-day-long seminar that I went to that was all about commercial property in Annapolis, Maryland. I don't remember what year, but I think that was 07 that I went to that. Maybe it was 09. Might have been 09, right in that neck of the woods. And I learned about commercial, all sorts of, you know, areas of commercial property. And when I learned about self-storage at that seminar, I immediately knew, this is it. That's for me. And the main thing that I really liked about it, I guess, were two things. One, when a tenant moves out, there's no painting, there's no new carpet. They're sweeping out a unit. And with a battery-powered leaf blower, it goes really quick. And then it's ready for the new tenant to move in, like, in an hour, or really in 10 minutes. And then the other thing is that my mortgage payment is not relying on one tenant. it's relying on a whole bunch of tenants paying me, say, $100, $200 each. So if someone moves out and I don't refill that unit for a couple days, a couple weeks, a couple months, no big deal. And so that put me on my quest to find a storage property, which I did immediately, but it was a very unusual situation, and it took, I don't know, 4 years or so to buy it.
I didn't get it
until April 2012. It was a foreclosure, became bank-owned, and all sorts of nonsense. It was a mixed-use property with storage, two storage buildings and two commercial buildings on the same property. And what I ended up doing was buying this from the bank, and we moved the printing company into the front storage or the front commercial building, and then I rented out some of the commercial spaces to other businesses, and then I rented out all the storage units. But when I bought the property, it was 95% vacant.
95?
Yeah.
Whoa. Gee, so it was a heck of an opportunity. If I'm curious to know, was this like something below $30,000 purchase? I don't need an exact number, but I'm just thinking about 95% vacancy rate. That's like...
Yeah. You know, you were buying the land and the buildings. The two storage buildings were pretty new. This is 2012 when I bought it. The one was built in 08. The other was built in 01. So those storage buildings were pretty new. The commercial building up front was older, but it was like built like Fort Knox, very solid masonry building, really built in 1959, kind of like a bomb shelter is how this place was built. And then there was another building that wasn't so great at the far rear of the property, built in the late 60s, early 70s, something like that. There was a couple storage tenants in there, in a couple of the storage units, but the rest of the property was vacant. And so after I bought it, we had to put, it took like 6 months to do major work. I mean, we're talking windows, doors, all interior finishes, rewired the whole building. We put in all new HVAC, I mean, units and ductwork. Rearrange things. The storage units, most of them were full of junk. We had to get 40-yard dumpsters and haul this crap out of there and put it into dumpsters that had been abandoned. And there was just the overgrown trees, shrubs. I mean, it was just a disaster. It really was a disaster.
So walk me through, it sounds like perhaps your investment into the property of fixing it up was probably more than what you bought it for. Is that fair?
No. I would say that my investment in fixing it up was less than what I bought it for, but not a lot less.
And so you have a 95% vacancy rate. Were you marketing it now? I mean, how did you get this shell of a building?
You're gonna love this. You're going to love this. So I knew that we were taking the front building and putting the printing company into, let's call it, three-quarters of the front building.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we got some storage units cleared out and ready to go, I put up an ad on Craigslist. I knew you'd like that. And I put a simple, I didn't even have a picture, nothing. Storage unit. I mean, it was
no
just
picture.
Simple where it was. I didn't have any pictures, Scott. I mean, it was really, really tight. But I did that, and people called, and they rented storage units from me. And so I bought it in April. We moved the printing company in in October. Or maybe it was by October 1st. I don't know. One of those two. And right around that same time, which was about 6 months after I bought it, I had rented all of the storage units.
6 months?
Yeah. did two things. I put an ad up on Craigslist. I mean, like basic of the most basic of basic ads on Craigslist. And I put a little, you know, like a real estate sign in the front yard that said storage unit for rent. And less than 6 months, we had them all occupied. And by December 1st, I had all the commercial spaces occupied.
That's amazing. So, that is amazing. So, like, I have to know, were there other storage, like, air centers within miles of this property? Were you, like, the only one?
Yeah. No, there's others close by. We're in this facility is a mile from my house. So, you know, we're in a suburban area right near the airport in Cleveland. And, I mean, not, like, right near, but, you know, let's call it 2 miles from the airport. In Cleveland, there's other storage facilities around. The only thing, let's call it unique about this property is some storage facilities have a lot of small units. This property has no small units. It has big and bigger units. So I have two unit sizes at this property. One of them is a 10 by 20, which is like a one-car garage. And then the other one is a 12 by 30 that is 10 feet high, which is not quite as big as a racquetball court, but like three quarters of the size of a racquetball court. I mean, it's pretty cavernous space. And those units are very difficult to find. Most storage facilities don't have anything that big. And contractors love those large units. And I love contractors as customers because they always, pretty much always pay their rent because this is where they store tools and materials. This is how they run their business, whether they're a plumber, electrician, or whatever. So they're going to pay their rent. And pretty much they're long-term tenants. I mean, we're talking years long-term.
So you really found a niche that wasn't being well served in the community.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't seek it out. I kind of stumbled across it, but yeah, I mean, I didn't realize that these storage units were going to be contractor units. But once contractors were the ones responding, I realized, like, oh, this is who this is perfect for.
Well, and from the little bit of, I have almost no experience in this area. Number one, I don't even use storage units because I'm cheap. You know, I don't do this stuff. So,
me either.
So I guess what I've heard as I've studied this, Seth Williams, previous podcast guest, had someone on his just a couple weeks before you and I are hopping on here. So it was like, oh, this is perfect. Now I can talk the lingo a little bit with Jeff, and what the guy was saying that this guy does is he goes in and they basically try and flip storage units within a few years. So they go in, fix it up, much of the same way you did, but perhaps without out the intention of necessarily selling it in as quick of a time frame. He said that what they like about storage is overall it has more recession proof than others. It tends to be lower cap rate, though, if you look at the numbers. Because of that dependability of income. But it's something that a lot of institutional investors, they only buy really large facilities, not kind of a smaller, relatively smaller facility. I'm curious to know, what's your take on what I just said? Is that fair, unfair?
It's absolutely accurate. I agree 100%. And I'll tell you, you know, this facility I bought with the intention of holding long term, and that's what I've done, and that's what I expect to continue to do. It is smaller, but it is very consistent and very reliable income source, largely because of these large units and long term tenants. And there's just not a lot to do there. It doesn't take a whole lot of time. Now, the second facility that I bought, which was in 2015, was twice as large. It had 8 buildings, had about 200 customers there. It was about 40,000 square feet on 4 acres. And it was the finest built facility in Ohio. The man that built it, it was kind of a hobby. He got a golden parachute and had he was looking for a place to go and have something to do, but it really he didn't need to make any money. And he had it for he built this thing, developed it, had it for a number of years, and I forget how many. And then I bought it, and it was 68% occupied when I bought it. The rates were very, very low, about half of what the market was. And there was no technology, no automation. And so I bought this thing, and within 100 days, we basically took it to 100% occupancy. I raised the rates 25% at the same time, continued raising them, introduced a whole bunch of new technology, put in a machine that's kind of like an ATM machine, except you can rent a storage unit with this. So I didn't need any employees, so I reduced the expenses significantly, increased the value of it, and it was making money. And then someone left me a voicemail from some private equity firm one day and said that they wanted to buy it. And I just thought it was a hoax, so I did respond. And after the third time over the course of a few weeks that the same guy left me the same message, I thought, well, maybe this guy's serious. And long story short, I had overtures from several other institutional investors as well. Because this was a prime property, it was of the right size, that these institutional investors want this for their portfolio for long-term cash flow. I had just sold the printing company. I didn't want to sell this thing. But then I started realizing that the market had swelled since I bought this. Remember, I just bought this the year before. And so I'm 16, 18 months into owning this, and I'm receiving hard offers for people to buy this facility. And it, I distilled it down. I ended up with, I think, nine people or entities that wanted to buy this, and it whittled down to three of them into a bidding war. And I, a little less than 2 years after I bought it, I sold it. I signed a purchase agreement for more than double what I paid for it. And
amazing.
I closed on that property 2 weeks or 2 years, 2 weeks and 2 days after I bought it for more than double what I paid for it.
Plus the cash flow you got along the way too.
Well, there's that, yeah. And I had I got a SBA loan on it, so I basically had no money into it of my own money. I had a 95% or 90% loan, and then they gave me money to add the things that I was, you know, technology I was adding. So I probably had $10,000 into the deal. I mean, it was
oh my gosh.
It's like almost an infinite return. And I wasn't planning on selling it. But it was one of those things like at some point you just have to say, okay, I guess this is what I'm meant to do. And it was because of what you said that this other guy said about the market. Now, that's not always been the case with the storage business, but in our climate today, the last several years today, that's the climate that we're in commercial real estate and specifically in self-storage, because there's so much private equity money flowing into these funds that will buy self-storage because it's looked upon as a safe haven, as a steady flow of cash, whether you're in recessionary times or not. And so it's actually softened a little bit since I sold that, which is a little over a year ago. I guess closing in on 2 years now that I look at it. But it softened a little bit. It was just like one of those amazing moments, and that'll probably never happen in my life again. I don't have any regrets in selling it, but it was certainly not the plan at all.
Would you buy another facility in the future? Now you've done this twice. Would you do this again?
I went right out to try and find another one, and I couldn't find anything that I was willing to buy because the market had swelled up so much that it didn't make sense for me to buy at that time. But given the right circumstances, I would definitely buy again. I'm kind of a buy an ugly duckling and fix it kind of a guy. And I've done that twice now. One literally looked bad. The other one just operationally looked bad. And I was able to add significant value to both of them. One I've kept and one I sold. But I would definitely do it again, given the right opportunity. And I have looked at a few over the last year or so and haven't been close to pulling the trigger. But opportunities are out there. And given the right circumstance, I would definitely buy another one.
So if you were one of us and I'm like, man, this is amazing, I would love to have the opportunity, even if we can't flip it like you did, just to have residual income, only work 10 hours a week. I mean, that sounds amazing. What would you be looking for if you're someone that's brand new, haven't had any exposure to this at all? Maybe you've had exposure with other types of real estate, but never in storage. What would you be thinking about? How would you be looking at deals? Would you stay local and close? Would you look farther away? Tell me about all of that.
Gosh, I think it depends on your life circumstances and kind of where you're at and what's important to you. You know, if you're someone that has a pretty demanding job that takes a lot of time, like a doctor, then I think that I would suggest looking at storage differently than if you were someone who was, say, an entrepreneur who has some flexibility in their time and someone more like you, Dave, because I think that there's different approaches to this. And I also think that if, you know, for someone that is thinking like they want to take an ugly duckling and fix it up and either hold it or sell it, versus they're just looking for a place to take some cash and invest it and park it and get some nice steady cash flow off of it. Those are kind of two different models. And then within those two, of course, there's different ways to break it down. If you want to be active in it, then I certainly recommend it to be local. But if you basically don't have time, but you've got money and you want to invest in it and park it in, then it doesn't need to be local. And there's so many property management companies that can professionally manage your facility, and you basically don't have to do anything. They do it all, and they're professional self-storage property managers. That I would go that route, you know, if you're kind of in that kind of a situation. And at that point, it doesn't matter whether it's nearby you or far away.
Mm.
So I really think it really depends on where, sort of where you're coming from.
Interesting. Well, I love how you broke that down. And I think that's something for all of us to consider. Which of those do you want us to be in? It's something that I believe, and I've said here before, I think too many people pass things off too quickly without fully understanding it. So I think hiring a management company is a good thing, but if you don't know what a management company should be doing, I think you could get yourself in a world of trouble.
Yes, you certainly can. And there certainly are different ways to structure that kind of a thing. Those type of management contracts. If someone is thinking about going down that road, I would definitely look at one of the companies who that's their core business. That's what they do, and there's a bunch of them out there. Some of them are big, and some of them are, you know, smaller, more regional. But there's a number of publications, magazine type, and then also books. In the self-storage industry. This industry historically has been very mom-and-pop and very fragmented. You know, when I got into the business just a few years ago, you know, it was 90% mom and pops. Let me think how to say this. 90% of the facilities in the U.S. had single owners. So one person or a couple owned one facility. And the companies, the big names that, that you've undoubtedly seen that have facilities throughout a region or throughout the nation, they were less than 10% of the entire market. Which is just amazing that, that this industry, because it was still a young industry, it's still highly fragmented. In the last number of years, that has changed a lot, but those numbers haven't changed a lot. And I don't know the exact numbers, but based on what I've heard, I would venture to say that currently, instead of less than 10% are with the top handful of operators, you're probably looking at maybe 13% is with the top handful of operators. I mean, it's changed, but it's not, it's not dramatic. And so there's a lot of opportunity for someone to get into this business and own a facility. Generally, I would say that those facilities that you, an individual is going to buy, they're not in a primary market. They're in a suburban area. They're in a secondary or maybe even a tertiary market. They're not the one in that metropolitan, that core of the metropolitan area, because those are the ones where the big boys are focused on, and they've got money to spend, and they're gonna be able to bid more than you on that. Go to places that are more suburban or on the edge of suburban to rural. Those are where the opportunities exist, in my opinion.
That was the same advice in Seth's podcast by that guy. Very interesting.
I didn't even listen to that.
You should. You would dig it. You'd probably be nodding your head the whole time.
I'm gonna now. Now that you mentioned it, I am gonna go listen to that one.
And so, gosh, we're going along here, but I think that there's just so much good stuff. I just appreciate your time, Jeff. And I guess I would love to know from you. I think I'm just going to skip talking about land. We might have to do that again at some point in the future. With all the entrepreneurship stuff that you've done, how are you involving your kids in the business, if at all, in the businesses that you've had?
Yes, I am. I participated in that as a child, and so I couldn't have it any other way. For my boys, I brought work home from the printing company. I mean, we were a lot bigger company when they were young, but before we sold it, so we had more staff to do things. But I still brought work home, and they still participated and did things there. They've done work over at our rental homes, and
like what? Can you think of an example? What did they do? Cut the grass.
Cut the grass. Rip up carpet. Off the top of my head, that's what I think of. But the year I bought the first storage facility, we bought it in April, and most of that renovation work was done over the summer. My wife affectionately refers to that summer as the summer from hell. because like I worked like 20 hours a day that summer, 7 days a week, to make that all happen. And so if she and the boys were going to see me, they came over there. Of course, if they were over there, I put them to work. but they did a lot of different things there. And they helped in the move of the printing company, which is a huge operation to just like move everything. Make physically, but also just like dealing with technology and everything. I mean, there's so much involvement in a move of something of that nature. But they were involved in that. They helped with some paperwork, stuffing of envelopes and things like that, with the land business, with the storage business, mailing out invoices or things. They've helped out up there with blowing out a unit, storage unit, when someone's moved out. You know, just little things like that.
And how do you incentivize them, or how are you treating them? Are you saying, okay, this, because you're part of the family, you know, this is your duty, and there's no pay involved? Or are you paying them or incentivizing them somehow? Are you having them, like in the land business, a lot of them are small deals. Are they participating in that in any way?
We haven't done that yet, but we've talked about that. And I think that in 2019, they will start participating in some deals. You know, they've had their own little business the last couple of summers with a lemonade stand at the corner. During
classic,
they don't sell lemonade though. They sell water, Gatorade, and popsicles. During Cleveland Browns headquarters is two blocks from my house, and during their training camp for about 2.5 weeks in the summer, just hundreds of people go to training camp to watch them practice, and so they'll walk by and buy a bottle of Gatorade or a bottle of water from the boys, and they've made some serious coin. The last two summers working out there, and they've learned a lot about business doing that, and so they want to reinvest some of that money into land, and so I think we're going to be ready to make that happen here pretty soon. But to get back to your sort of original question there, sometimes they don't get paid. Sometimes this is just an expectation. This is just part of our family, and there's other things that they do get paid for. And I don't know that I have a good breakdown of you know, when one situation applies and when another does, and I'm probably a bit inconsistent with that. But they definitely bring value, but I also know that they're getting a huge amount of value, just like I did at that age.
Wow, that's great. That is great. And, Jeff, as we wrap up the podcast today, you've had many different businesses. You have a new one with the land business. I would love to know from you, are physicians, those of us that haven't gone to business school, it's something I hear so often. We were never taught this stuff because they've gotten all this training, right? They've had 4 years of medical school, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years of residency and fellowship. And quite often, business and running a practice gets lost along the way. And building wealth and how to do that never gets taught. So I would love to know from you, if you could boil down to maybe one or two lessons of how you've done well with yourself and your life, what would you like to pass on to us?
I think the most important one is live below your means. In your business and in your personal life. If you can take a nice chunk of your salary, your income, and sock it away, whether it's in real estate or something else, I think that that is one of the most valuable things that you can do for your long-term wealth. I did that as a teenager, and it was because of the modeling of how my dad ran the printing company and ran our family finances. And I think that's the most important thing. I really do. And as far as, like, you know, not going to business school and, you know, where do you learn that stuff? Gosh. There's so many places. You may have something, Dave, but a list of business books, and some of them aren't even business books per se. They're kind of more life books. I think that you can learn a lot from those. And you know, one of them, if you don't really know anything about business, I think that the Rich Dad series, I think, is a great place to start. Starting with Rich Dad, Poor Dad, it gives you a really grounded, simple understanding of what the differences are between a business owner, employee, being self-employed, I think that's a good place to start if you're looking for a place to start.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for your mentorship, Jeff, and I just really appreciate you and the chances we've had to work together, and I'm looking forward to learning more about storage stuff from you personally, and hopefully one of these days I can grow up and be just like you when I grow up, to have all these multiple streams of big income and flipping big deals and just inspirational. I think the work ethic and the grind, and now in a different phase of life that you're in, that you're able to sit back and not work 60, 70 hours a week, and to have these streams of income pay for the family and still teaching the kids entrepreneurship lessons. I think what a fantastic journey. And congratulations to you, sir, on all that you've done.
Well, thank you. You're too kind. It's just my life, and it's just what I've cobbled together and pieced together and done. And it's worked for me and my family, and you know, it's not the way to do it. Everyone has their own path. Everyone has their own combination of things, and that's the beautiful thing about this, is that you can do it in a way that works for you, which is going to be different than what it is for everyone else. So don't spend any time or energy trying to copy me or Dave or anyone else. This is for you to do what I did and learn from what other people are doing, and then figure out what works for you, and then go do it.
That is such great advice, and I think some of it just has to be passion and what you're passionate about to a degree. But I think certainly doing underwater basket weaving, you know, that's not going to make money. So you have to figure out not only what you're passionate about, but also what makes money, you know, that kind of perfect combination and experiment, which is what my show has been about the last couple of years, is telling you guys what I'm experimenting with and what's working and not working. And guess what? I'm not going to stop experimenting ever. We're always going to be trying and testing new things and seeing what works. And that's true in my finances. That's true in the land business. And Jeff, that's something I see in you too. You're not afraid to test and try and fail from time to time in order to get to be successful.
Absolutely.
And Jeff, if people want to check you out or connect, what do you think would be the best way to do that?
Probably connect on Facebook. Would probably be the easiest way for a lot of people. You can just find my name there, Jeff Detmer, Dettmer, and should be able to find me pretty easily there.
All right, there you go. Well, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate you being with us, my friend.
Oh, you're very welcome.
All righty, folks. Well, there you go. Another episode in the can of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. I hope this was inspirational. I hope this gave you some ideas and inspire you to create your own multiple streams of income. Jeff gave us some fantastic mentorship. Have any questions? Feel free to hit me up, Dave at drfreedompodcast.com, or of course, go to the website www.drfreedompodcast.com. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Appreciate you listening in. Check in anytime. Bye-bye.
All right, my friends, that wraps it up for today, and just want to remind you, make sure to check out everything that I have ever built in the last 4 years for this podcast. You can get it all for less than $100 by going to drfreedompodcast.com/system. Again, that's drfreedompodcast.com/system. Get the latest books, all the manuals, all the audio to get your financial education all in one place. Again, drfreedompodcast.com/system.